What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Russia and its new place in our thinking is one of the truly bizarre stories of our times. They were pinned to the mat more convincingly than any of the guys Vince McMahon sent in to take on Hulk Hogan in his day. How have they once again become the center of our attention? It wasn't that long ago we couldn't go a week without thinking about the old Soviet Union, a true adversary of the old order, armed to the teeth, competitive technologically. Remember Sputnik? Mutually assured destruction and an economic system, the antithesis of ours. East versus West involved proxy wars all over the globe, and there was doubt as to which system would prevail, except in America. We always thought we were the good guys, and in our fiction, they won out time and again. Plot spoiler, we did win out in the end, or so we thought. When the Iron Curtain fell, boom, there it goes, and the emperor, or czar, it was revealed, had no clothes, and no countries under its sphere of influence. We won, or so it seemed. In truth, our mishandling of so much of our foreign policy, since we've been free to roam the world as the only reigning superpower, will be one of the great legacies for historians to chomp on in the period ahead. How did we squander our place in the world? While democracies and freedom have sprung up in many unlikely places, you have to feel that we could have made better relations with Russia over this time and have helped to nurture more civil societies in the Middle East to avoid the viciousness of their most dispossessed lashing out all across the globe. So the question on the table in this America Trends feature is whether we could have done better in developing relations with that newly minted free market, kinda, Russia, or was it inevitable that friction would remain between us to the point where they now play a key role in the world, despite having lost the Cold War and being virtually bankrupt as a nation? How is that possible? And what happens from here? Let's turn to Evan Roth Smith for some of the answers that we need. He's a political strategist who, shortly after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, traveled extensively throughout Europe and the former Soviet Union, conducting interviews with senior diplomats and politicians, which became the basis for the book he co-authored called Putin's Master Plan. So, Evan, what is the plan?
Well, Putin clearly has a master plan to destroy NATO and other American alliances around the world and roll back American power and global influence and replace it with Russian power and global influence. And we see that plan at work every day in places like Ukraine and Syria and North Korea, and also in our own headlines where Putin has become perhaps the biggest story in American politics.
When you look at Russian history, over the course of the 20th century to the present, you see the volatility. It's stunning. From the czars to democracy to communism to purges, the world wars and the devastation there, the fall of the empire, and then this odd sort of strongman democracy. How can we, as Americans, with relative stability and nothing destroying our homeland during the world wars, begin to understand all this?
Well, it's very difficult to understand how events like that impact a country and impact its psychology. We can sympathize, we can empathize, but the trauma that they went through, not just during Soviet communism and before them, but even in the 90s when their economy collapsed, their society collapsed, their safety net collapsed. People were jobless. There were no pensions. There was no Social Security. They had none of their equivalents of Medicare or Medicaid. It was truly a society in free fall, and Putin has salvaged so much of that for them, and as a strongman leader who has brought Russia back from the brink of the bad old days of the Yeltsin years, he is respected and appreciated for his contributions.
Well, I was talking about all the other cataclysms that they have felt, wondering which one affects their aggressive posture around the world today. But I forgot to mention, as you just did, about Boris Yeltsin. Explain how important his time in office was.
Well, Yeltsin, inherited this country. He was massively popular in the breakup after the breakup of the Soviet Union. Everyone had very high hopes, the policies he pushed with the help of European and American governments and with economists from all over the world and including some forward thinkers from within Russia itself who wanted to liberalize the Russian economy and introduce democracy and capitalism into their country. They really got very creative in what they sought to do to Russia, and there were very high hopes and they were probably justified, but it was largely a disaster for the Russian people. As we just discussed, their society and their economy basically collapsed. And so that era, which Putin brought to a close when he succeeded Boris Yeltsin, is deeply ingrained in the Russian psyche as a period of bad decisions and bad outcomes. And the policies associated with that period are widely disparaged. And Putin has gone in the opposite direction by reasserting state control of much of the economy. And of clamping down on political critics and limiting democracy, running in exactly the opposite direction of where Yeltsin went, sabotaged by the mob and by, frankly, the people who have now become the oligarchs who weren't interested in the betterment of the country's economy. But it was such a disaster for so many people that the policies associated with that period of time, with the failure of Yeltsin, are rightly or wrongly considered unwelcome by many Russians. They don't want to go back to the bad old days, but their bad old days were democratizing and rapid change over to capitalism. And so state control, reasserted state control of the economy and of society, like what Putin has accomplished in restoring stability, has persuaded many Russians that that is how their country should be run.
The inferiority complex that Russia has toward the U.S. and the West, describe their resentments toward what they've seen in terms of our wealth and the various attributes of the United States.
Well, it's very hard to lose a war. Fortunately, the United States does not lose really any of them on our own turf. We've never had our country collapse the way they've had. We've never had our government collapse, save perhaps the Civil War, which was obviously very traumatic. But think of the trauma that losing a war like Vietnam inflicted on the United States, what that did to our society, the radical change in how people thought and who people trusted in the United States. And then think of that magnified a million times. The Soviet Union lost a massive global struggle. Their government collapsed. Their ideology was discredited. Their economy disintegrated. People lost their livelihoods. They lost their careers. There was violence in many parts of the Soviet Union. People lost their lives in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so losing the Cold War absolutely inflicted a deep psychological trauma, but also a very real and tangible trauma on Russia. And that is translated into, exactly as you said, this sort of inferiority complex of how do we get back to where we were, which was a global superpower that was respected and feared all over the world.
What should their recent aggressions in Georgia and Ukraine have told the United States and the West about their psyche to reclaim a sphere of influence lost at the end of the Cold War?
Well, Georgia and Ukraine and also what we've seen in places like Syria, they sent a clear message, and Putin was not subtle in these military operations. They sent a clear message that Russia is not just going to sit back and be another peaceful country. They're not just going to get along with their neighbors. They are not just going to, like many European countries do. Belgium does not have designs on the territory of its neighbors, right? Belgians are concerned about making Belgium a better country and a more prosperous country and, there are internal parochial issues. The Russians, clearly, and especially under the leadership of Putin, are not going to be a country like that.
should what we saw happen in these two places have been met with more resistance by the West? And explain what it is that we actually did do in terms of sanctions and the like.
Sure. Well, absolutely, both should have been met with more resistance. Georgia was timed well by Vladimir Putin. You know, it was August of 2008, very shortly after the Georgian War. We had a presidential changeover. The last thing that Barack Obama wanted to start his presidency with was, you know, a major military confrontation with Russia, which is why he did the reset, even you know, while Russian troops were still occupying and still today do occupy large portions of Georgia, about a fifth of the country. And so the Russian reset that Obama attempted early on in his presidency was probably naive and a little misinformed in how to deal with Putin, who had made very clear that he was going to be aggressive and that he was going to be invading countries and that he had designs on the territories of his neighbors. Ukraine made that even more abundantly clear and made it clear that we have to take much more much stronger and more sophisticated measures to put a stop to what Putin is trying to accomplish. And while the sanctions regime, which today targets certain high-level Russian banks and certain individuals in Putin's inner circle, almost certainly needs to be expanded. You know, depending on where you live in the United States, you can drive down the road and see a Lukoil gas station, which is a gas company that's, you know, like right next to a Shell, right next to a
Yeah, I've seen that. I never realized that was
Lukoil,
Russian.
Lukoil is fully owned by the Russian government. And so, you know, those it's things like that. We could very easily sanction Lukoil and shut them down in the United States. Of course, the trick is that Russia does very little business with the United States. They do much more business with the European Union and with other and with countries like the UK, which is no longer in the European Union, or shortly will not be. But by doing so much business with Europe and so little with the United States, it means that Europe is really the entity that has the leverage on Russia with sanctions. And what we need to do is put pressure on the Europeans to be better about implementing their sanctions regime and strengthening it.
Is it fair to say that Vladimir Putin is one of the best poker players in the world? I mean, he's playing a lousy hand, it seems to me, and yet he suffers few losses when he becomes adventurous as it relates to military, and he keeps his people really excited about their muscle flexing and nationalism, while the vast majority somehow suffer economically but are brought to rousing appreciation for what it is that he's trying to make as a statement about Russia on the world stage.
You're exactly right, and you're right that he has played a mediocre to weak hand very strongly. And in fact, one of the best assessments of how the United States needs to deal with Putin that I've heard was from someone who said, "You know, Putin's a very good gambler. We just have to make him a more cautious gambler. We need to convince him that it's not worth taking the risks he's taking with the weak hand he has." Because he will always be this guy who takes gambles and who pushes the envelope and who always pushes until he meets resistance. And we need to offer resistance earlier and more often, and it needs to be stronger.
When you look at the Russian image, how important is that to the people of Russia, and how much will they accept in terms of choking off their freedoms and limiting their economic opportunities as long as Russia is looking as if it's trying to recreate an important role that it had on the world stage?
Right. Well, many Russians hold Putin accountable for the state of the economy directly, you know, much in the same way that Americans hold our president and our Congress accountable for the state of the economy. And when there are food shortages, when it's superficial sanctions, like sanctions on a Russian bank that doesn't really impact most ordinary Russians, they go about their day, it doesn't matter that the place they bank at is sanctioned in the Netherlands or the United States or wherever. As long as they can go to their ATM and go to their local branch in Russia, it doesn't bother them. So when it's these sort of superficial sanctions, it doesn't have much impact, and it has exactly the result that you alluded to, which is Putin can campaign on it. He can say, look, you know, it's the Americans and the Europeans trying to hurt us like they always do, and ordinary Russians buy that. When the sanctions become much more impactful on the everyday life of ordinary Russians, which there were food shortages. About a year and a half ago, there were issues with vegetables being Putin did some retaliatory sanctions on the Europeans that prevented them from importing vegetables and other sort of produce. In fact, they were destroying imported European produce when many Russians were having trouble affording their groceries. That they didn't blame on the Americans, that they blamed on Putin. So when the sanctions cross to the level that they actually impact the livelihood of ordinary Russians, then they hold Putin accountable, and then there's internal pressure on him to do something differently in how he deals with America and Europe and the Middle East.
Evan Roth Smith is with us, co-author of the book Putin's Master Plan. You know, America was the lone superpower walking around the world stage very boldly there for a period of time. And, of course, this whole idea of NATO expansion very close to Russia. Have we overplayed our hand? I mean, that's what it seems to me he's trying to say.
Well, you know, this whole argument of NATO encirclement that Putin likes to use, it's sort of very funny because he wants us to believe that that NATO countries around him are a threat to Russia, but he also wants us to believe that Russia is not a threat to its neighbors. And because NATO is a purely defensive alliance, those two, you know, positions are sort of contradictory because there are plenty of countries that are encircled fully by NATO, like Switzerland is completely encircled by NATO on all sides, with the exception of Austria. And the Swiss don't have a problem with being encircled by NATO because the Swiss aren't trying to invade their neighbors. So it doesn't really matter. Putin, on the other hand, is trying to invade his neighbors. So it matters that he is encircled by NATO countries.
Does he really intend to destroy Europe? I mean, if he had his druthers, to totally divide NATO, reclaim Russian influence in the world, and marginalize the U.S., that seems like quite a palette to be brushing from these days, I mean, given the position that he's in. Is he even really thinking in those terms?
Well, I think you can criticize Putin for many things, but lack of ambition isn't one of them. I think he has the grandest of designs on the shape of Europe in the future. And he does want to, you know, when we say destroy Europe, it's not like he wants to carpet bomb Paris. He wants to destroy European institutions like the European Union and like NATO, and even the sort of less formal ties that bind Europeans together, like a belief in free markets and liberal democracy and these sorts of things. And in many ways, he's succeeding over there. And we've seen, you know, how successful Putin can be at dividing countries in our own experience here in the last 6 months. We've seen Putin become an incredibly divisive issue, Russia become an incredibly divisive issue. And it's no accident. He's been doing the same thing in Europe for the last decade and a half.
Now, the tactics that he's been using, you're starting to describe them. And as we look at interference in our 2016 election and the attempts to interfere in other elections in Europe, I mean, how big a part of his strategy is this?
It's a major part of his strategy. And in part, it's in order to destabilize countries that attempt to weaken Russia, whether it's France or the United States or the United Kingdom. But it's also in order to discredit democratic institutions in those countries. Because in many cases, the actual outcome of the election is not what Putin is targeting. He doesn't care so much about whether candidate X or candidate Y wins. He cares that people lose faith in their democratic process. And that particularly Russians in Russia who are watching these elections can dismiss them as unnecessary, as flawed, as problematic, as you know, unneeded in their own country. And we've seen the havoc that he can wreak on the democratic process with really very minimal effort to get involved. It's not like he hacked the voting machine. He hacked a couple emails and put them on the internet. You know, it's really not rocket science. And our whole democracy went into a tailspin. And he's done exactly the same thing in the Baltic countries. In Ukraine, he's gone considerably farther. He actually, Russian hackers penetrated the Ukrainian, the equivalent of the Federal Election Commission. They wound up getting false election results posted on a government website in Ukraine during the presidential. He really will go that far. And it's also seen in France, some intervention in Germany, some intervention. He tests the waters, and he figures out ways to discredit these institutions and weaken the democratic processes of these countries.
How important is it that he sees that the United States has been so divided in the recent period, so partisan, unable to get things done, and not truly a bulwark against some of his aggression? Does that embolden him?
Oh, it certainly emboldens him, in part because he's helped create that environment in the last year or so. But he wants a weak America. He wants an America that isn't capable of taking unified consensus action. He wants an American people who have politicized Russia as an issue instead of dealing with it as it is, which is America is not a friend of Russia. Russia is not a friend of America. That applies to basically all of our country, with the exception of a few people who have been misled or misguided into believing that Russia is a friend of the United States.
Well, how did Donald Trump, go this entire campaign saying very little, if anything, about what was going on, his concerns about Russia? Where was he? Already you have said in your book that the Obama administration was naive regarding Russia. You said George W. Bush said that he saw his soul, and yet he thought he could do business with him, but he really couldn't. Where's Donald Trump coming from?
That's a very good question. I think that's a question that's asked about many, many stances that that Trump takes, not just on Putin and Russia. it is important that Trump internalize the lessons of the Obama presidency in ways that Obama failed to internalize the lessons of the Bush presidency. As I was saying earlier, Obama came into office hot on the heels of the Russian invasion of Georgia. It was very clear by that point that George Bush had misjudged Putin, saying he could, see into his soul and he was a good man and all that sort of stuff. It was clear he had misjudged him. And Obama had all that evidence coming into office, and he also misjudged what the situation was. And he believed that we could build a better relationship with Russia. He tried to do it on day one, and Putin took advantage of him in order to build up his conventional and nuclear military capabilities. And then in the last days of the Obama presidency, deploy those military capabilities in Ukraine and in Syria to devastating effect. And if Trump does not learn those lessons from Obama's failures, then Putin will continue to take advantage of America's weakness.
Well, why should we imagine that Donald Trump is going to learn from any of this? If Putin's goal is the eventual breakup of NATO, which has been a check on Russian aggression, President Trump is really just rolling over, at least at the beginning here. He said, we're not friends, we're not enemies, we really don't know each other. And yet, of course, there's this notion that's surrounding all these investigations that there might have been some collusion. Some of it might be based on financial interests. You, as a journalist and somebody who has studied so many of these issues, what does this all feel like to you?
Well, it feels like indecisiveness. It feels like weakness. It feels like an unwillingness to take a principled stand on an issue that demands a principled stand. I hope that Trump quickly learns that the only way to succeed with Russia and with Putin is through strength, that the only thing Putin respects is strength, and that if Trump, extends a hand in friendship, he should expect it could be spat in by the Russians sooner or later, perhaps later rather than sooner. Which is exactly what happened to Obama, who extended a hand on day one and, wound up quite embarrassed by that by the end of his presidency.
Has American credibility on the Russian threat fallen to such a new low, Evan, when you look at this, that allies have to be very leery of any American leadership on this issue?
I think, unfortunately, they do. The recent news about Rex Tillerson potentially skipping a NATO meeting in order to go meet in Moscow is very discouraging. That's not what you want to hear. If you're an American ally, you want them to take the meeting. You want us to take the meeting. And so, it is very discouraging, and I hope we see a change of course on that front.
Does America really have to stand up if we are going to be the leader of the free world? What does that imply directly about the need to confront Russia at this moment in time?
Well, You know, it's debatable what whether America can still call itself the leader of the free world in the current global environment, and of course, what the free world actually entails these days, who we would be leading. Russia certainly sees us as the enemy, as the principal enemy. In fact, it's reflected in their strategic documents, in government documents. They highlight America as their primary strategic opponent. They are not being subtle. They are not being coy. They're all the way out there, and we need to appreciate that and understand that and understand how they see us. Russia has a target on us. And Putin has been relentless and very effective in dismantling our alliance system and weakening us around the world. Unless we do something about it, he's going to continue to be successful.
And the allies, as they're looking on at these investigations going on, the Senate, the House, the FBI, what are they imagining has been going on here, if it's not just the Russians doing what they do in terms of everyone's elections and trying to undermine the democratic structures of these societies? Worse yet, the idea of some type of collusion by one of the candidacies.
Well, now I think a lot of Europeans are thinking, well, now the Americans understand what we've been dealing with and what we've been putting up with as far as Russian interference for quite a few years, and which often America was too dismissive of. There are many political parties in Europe now that are fully bankrolled by the Russians, whose leaders regularly travel to Moscow.
Le Pen's party in France?
Like Le Pen, Le Pen's party took $10 million, I believe, maybe 22 separate 10 million euro loans, I believe the numbers are, from a Russian-controlled bank out of Cyprus or something like that, the Czech Republic. It's par for the course in Europe. It's just a day in the political life of these countries. So I think when they see what's happening here, they go, welcome to the club. We've been doing this for years.
Now, you said that the fact that we had a defensive missile shield program and we stopped that, what signal did that send? And are we going to have to complete that in the future in order to regain some legitimacy among our NATO allies?
I think we do have to finish the NATO missile shield, which was a project that we had initiated with European support and cooperation. It was a missile shield we were building across several European countries, NATO countries, that would protect all of Europe and all of the United States from missile attack by Russia or Iran or anyone else in that part of the world. And we stopped short of completing it. Obama decommitted, if you will, from finishing that project. And we do need to fully finish it, because European countries like Poland that were relying on that missile shield to be finished to protect them from Russia, now they look at Russian troops occupying parts of Ukraine and they go, well, we sure would like to have that missile shield now. So as both a show of good faith and as a real security improvement for Europe and the United States, finishing the missile shield just makes all the sense in the world.
What about modernizing our nuclear arsenal?
Well, that's, a perennial need. Of course, it costs a lot of money. But the first thing we need to do is stop signing these deals, like the New START Treaty, which was this outrageously terrible deal for the United States that actually set a limit on nuclear warheads that was below our stockpile level and above Russia's. So we had to decrease our deployed nuclear warheads, but Russia was able to increase them under that treaty, which is, it doesn't take Donald Trump to figure out that that's a bad deal. And it's these sort of clueless, and that was done in order to secure Russian cooperation on the Iranian sanctions, which, of course, we've now discontinued. But that treaty is still in place. And so, it makes you scratch your head. Why America would handicap itself on nuclear defense and nuclear parity with Russia.
Rex Tillerson is now our Secretary of State. We're looking to diminish the amount of money that he has, the number of diplomats, and even our defense chief is saying, well, then give me more bullets. What are the diplomatic levers that we have available to us to deal with this Russian threat?
Well, again, Putin is always happy to sit down and have a conversation. He's happy to engage in diplomacy. He just doesn't abide by the outcomes. We had the Minsk conference, over the Ukraine conflict that was meant to result in some sort of ceasefire or peace or whatever you want to call it, that became effectively just a piece of paper, and Putin regularly violated it, and it, you know, the violence continued in Ukraine, and he's happy to engage in the diplomatic process, but unless you have real leverage, hard power leverage, whether it's economic, like the Europeans have, or whether it's military, like we have, unless he feels that there will be consequences to his failure to abide by the diplomatic process, he won't.
Internally, we saw just recently these protests in Russia, and lots of people were surprised that so many young people decided to come out and vent their frustration and their anger. Is it more likely that Putin faces a threat from external sources versus internal, or really could it be internally driven?
Well, we see these, you know, pressure releases in Russia of the sort of pent-up resentment. And then, of course, there's a significant portion of the Russian electorate does not like Vladimir Putin and would vote against him. He rigged his elections, but even if he didn't, he'd probably still win, you know, in excess of 60% of the vote. That still does mean that 30 to 40% of the country has a real problem with him, especially young people in the cities who wish they lived, you know, a few hundred miles to the west in a place like Berlin or in Paris or in Prague or wherever, even Warsaw, where they would have more economic freedom, more opportunities, more rights. Moscow can be a nice place to live if you're an oligarch, but if you're a young professional trying to get ahead in the world, it's not so great, which is why many of their young people leave. And so the ones who have stayed are not all that happy. And, you know, that does present an internal threat to Putin. It is probably not, I would say almost certainly not, a critical mass to create actual political change.
I've got to get your take on this, Evan. The founder of the Open Russia movement wrote in the Wall Street Journal that for today's regime in Moscow, the overriding goal is to defer the inevitable question of leaving power. Military adventurism, like the police state itself, is a means to an end. He's been in power for nearly 18 years. Of course, he gave up the presidency for a moment in time, but really held on to power, in effect. Could the White House pull Russia out of its spiral, he said, by negotiating a peaceful transfer of power? Is he worried about this, and could the United States play a role in that?
He's definitely worried. I mean, Putin has to think about a successor. He had this sort of test run with Medvedev that went okay. It was sort of a B-minus, how Medvedev did. He'll be in power. Putin will be in power. He amended the Constitution to extend the presidential term, so he'll be in power until 2024. And at that point, he will be significantly older, and presumably the world will be significantly different, including Russia's place in the world. And he has to think about who comes next. And so if he, you know, seriously considers that, then, you know, will he allow America to have a role in that? I seriously doubt it.
Well, there is now this talk, and one documentary done by CNN suggested that he is not only the most powerful man in the world, but also the richest man in the world. So he wants to hold on to all. I mean, it's amazing what he has collected, aside from what he admits to having, which is a 900-square-foot apartment and a 200-square-foot garage. But tell us, I mean, does he just want to hold on to power or wealth or both?
I mean, D, all of the above. You know, it's he really is one of these people who has almost unfathomable power. He directs the entire Russian state. He has also, you know, one of these reasons why his wealth is so difficult to estimate is, you know, what in Russia doesn't Putin control? What doesn't, in effect, he own in some capacity or another? And so his many properties, his many bank accounts, by the way, many of which are maintained in supposed American allies, like Switzerland. You know, they're happy to take Putin money and oligarch money, as is London, in the city of London, the bankers there. They're happy to take oligarch money. They don't seem to mind too much that it's money that comes from an American enemy, and a British enemy, for that matter. But he does want to hold on to all the money and as much of the power as he can keep. Frankly, and we'll see what that looks like in in, you know, about 8 years.
What do you see derailing Putin's master plan? Anything?
A strong United States that commits fully to putting the brakes on Putin and commits fully to its European security partnerships and to backing its allies in the Middle East and in East Asia, especially the Japanese, the Taiwanese, the South Koreans, who are standing up to Putin and to China and to North Korea. But if we really rededicate ourselves to our security commitments in these places and we defend the values, you know, America's out of practice since the Cold War of defending things like democracy and free markets and human rights. They've seemed self-evident for so long, but they're not really anymore, and in part because of people like Putin who have actively undermined them. So we need to get better at being advocates, and we need to get better at being, you know, in real time supporting and committing resources, both military and diplomatic and economic and otherwise, to defending these values and advocating for our interests.
So what did happen when we were the lone superpower on the world stage? How much did we squander, as you see it? And are we still the lone superpower, or do you see China or Russia really making a play in that regard?
Well, I mean, I think any American can tell you that they feel like we squandered the opportunity we had in many ways. America today and the world today is not as well off as it was perhaps 15, 20 years ago. Some places are doing quite a bit better, Russia and China among them. But, you know, today, and, you know, if you scan the headlines and compare them to the headlines in a year like 2000, it's quite different. And I don't think Americans feel more secure in their country or in their livelihoods or in our position in the world today than they did 15 years ago or even 20 years ago. And so I think quite a bit has been squandered. Whether or not America is still the lone superpower, we're certainly the most powerful country in the world. Places like China are closing the gap. Places like Russia are, if not closing the gap, then playing weak hands strongly, as we discussed. It's clear that Russia is probably more powerful than we are in places like the Middle East right now. Because they're willing to use the power they have much more aggressively than we are.
Okay. Evan Roth-Smith, I want to thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thanks again for having me, Larry.
If you like this episode of America Trends podcast, will you please leave us a kind rating or a review on iTunes? John, is that too much to ask?
No, or even a comment. Give Anything. Us in the comment section on the ones that you liked. And you know, you can also email me at newsletter@rifkinradio.com. And that's another way you can contact us with your ideas.
Don't forget, your review really is important to us. And John, they may say, why is it so important? Well, the more Well, the more you like us, the better placement we get, which then helps us improve our rankings and visibility so that more people can enjoy us. And the more people, John, you see how this is spiraling?
It's getting out of control there.
The more people who know about us and like our content, the greater chance we have to encourage advertisers to hop aboard. You see how it works now, John?
I understand now. That's very interesting.
And we don't want these folks who are listening to miss a single episode of America Trends podcast. I mean, we're recording tons of them, aren't we?
No, and they're all very interesting, and we got some really good stuff coming up.
Oh, we really do. But we want you to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher.com. And when you do subscribe, let us know on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle on both platforms is @TrendsPodcast. We want to thank you personally for subscribing. In fact, John may have a very beautiful thank you gift. John, what is it? No? Ran out of them?
All out of gifts.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
sorry
please,
about that.
Please send us your ideas and questions for future episodes and topics on America Trends podcast. We can't think of them all, right, John?
That's right.
I mean, my head's already exploding.
Oh, yes.
You see it? Cloud above. Is there an author you'd love to hear from? Or a subject you'd like to learn more about, send us your ideas on Facebook and Twitter. You can direct message us at at Trends Podcast or use hashtag Trends Podcast. You can also add an email address if you have one that you want to give out. And we do not, right, John? We don't share our lists.
No spamming, no list getting out. You just get our newsletter.
Absolutely. And you can access our full show archive on our website at americatrendspodcast.com. For more information on America Trends and for the latest updates on our upcoming episodes, be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can find us at Trends Podcast. Oh, by the way, and John, this is really important, and you know
what is it? What is it?
Well, if you buy from Amazon, we have joined their associates program. So you go to americatrendspodcast.com before you purchase, and you click over to Amazon from our Amazon store.
That's a very good point, because it doesn't cost them any more money to do that.
No, that's all built in.
And then we get a few pesos.
Yeah, but
keeping that podcast going.
You know, if we get a small VIG, you know, 2 or 3%, if you don't do it through us, you're just giving more money to Jeff Bezos.
Exactly.
And he doesn't need any more
money.
He
doesn't need it. That's
and he doesn't
correct.
Do any podcasts, I don't think. So please, with no added cost to you, it helps us to bring you the content that you're enjoying. And thanks.
Thanks, everybody.
Please keep listening.